This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It is Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal. And the latest is hyperlocal, even though it came from Doug Ford. So one of the all-time most popular neighborhood summer festivals is coming back this year after a two-year hiatus. It's the Taste of the Danforth. It is slated for August 7th, 8th, and 9th. The premier told us the province is good for some of the cost of it when he was on stage with Mayor Olivia Chow for another reason. And he was definitely not forthcoming when asked about her coy, maybe I will, maybe I won't, responses to questions about her re-election bid. Ford told the crowd that he doesn't get involved in local politics, and that is the biggest nose stretcher of all. And speaking of nose stretchers, of course, the biggest Canadian political news of the last 24 hours is out of Ottawa, with the floor crossing to the Liberals of Conservative MP Matt Généreux. Remember, he's the guy who denied rumors that this was in the offing before Christmas. Then he said he would not seek re-election because he wants to spend more time with his family, as if that wasn't the most tired, shop-worn explanation no one believes. And given that his riding has voted Conservative the last half a dozen times, they elected him both federally and provincially, well, there's no question that this is a betrayal. And my question to this panel will be, doesn't that just make people more cynical, more apathetic about politics and politicians? But, audience, what do you think? The text and long-distance phone line, 866-740-4740. The local phone lines open again, 416-360-0740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome Toronto City Councillors John Burnside for Ward 16, Don Valley East, sitting across from me here in the studio, Mike Cole, Ward 8, Eglinton Lawrence, and Stephen Holliday, Ward 2, Etobicoke Center. Hi, guys. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Libby.
Okay,
great. Great afternoon, Libby.
Okay, just before we get to the big things I've just highlighted, John, we just learned about this initiative from the federal government to add liaison officers to try to fight extortion at the municipal level. You're a former cop. Do you think this is what is needed to try to address the problem?
Well, I think it'll definitely help. I mean, how can it not? But I guess the question I have is, what took you so long? I know that Prime Minister Carney is a lot more, I'll say, focused on doing things that Canadians want and getting some action. But as opposed to the previous Prime Minister Trudeau, he just sort of seemed to slough things off. But the fact they're going to create a financial crime agency and they're going to dedicate experts to this, I mean, this has been going on for years. It's gotten worse in the last couple of years, especially or particularly in the South Asian community. As I say, it's just interesting that government always takes so long to react to these things, but absolutely moving in the right direction.
Okay, well, moving in the right direction for summer, we have news that the Taste of the Danforth is back on again, and I'm trying to see who is closer to it, Mike Cole or Stephen Holliday, but let's start with Stephen. What's your reaction to that, and are you thinking of any festivals a little closer to your base that you might like some more money for?
Well, there's all kinds of festivals in the city of Toronto. And as many people may know, ever since COVID, there's been increasing pressure. And I would attribute the pressure to things like requirements for plans around safety, having security present, the cost of bringing in experts to do, you know, lighting, the cost of insurance on these things, the cost of waste management. You know, the world certainly has changed, and so have people. And so many of the festivals have been put under pressure like they never have been before. And that's the great example in the Taste of the Danforth. One of the signature things that people know Toronto for and come here for, they had to stop their operations for 2 years. So it sounds like a government bailout is in the works. The big question that I've got is, if it's done for one, will it be done for others? You know, out here in Etobicoke, we have a lot of activity in Centennial Park. That's our large park here. Things like the Rib Fest that occurs over the Canada Day weekend. I know that that's run through the Rotary Club, and so it's volunteers that run that. And even they struggle to make sure all the finances work each year so they can produce an event. So, you know, does the municipality have a role in fostering these cultural events? Sure. I just don't know what the real financial picture is going to look like. And hey, good for Taste of the Danforth to achieve a provincial, some provincial funding to make sure that they operate.
Well, that's a very collegial and cooperative attitude. So I congratulate you on that. And of course, Etobicoke is Ford country. So I suspect, I suspect there might be help on the way there. Mike, what is your reaction to the return of the Taste of the Danforth?
Well, you know, I'm a bit cynical about this because, you know, we asked the provincial government and the federal government to help pay for the biggest cost that's occurring for festivals. We've got over 100 going on in the city. And the biggest cost, 87% increase in security costs. And this is a result of what happened, unfortunately, in Vancouver. It's happening all over the world where you get these hostile vehicles entering a festival area. And we've asked for money for security for these, you know, for these special barriers. They're called hostile vehicle mitigation barriers. We asked the provincial government, the federal government. Last year, we had a summit of small business where this is the one thing they asked for, is some funding for these barriers alone. No response. Yeah, it's great they're going to put on the Danforth. But as I think you said, and, you know, we've got 100 and plus of these all over the city. So you just can't bail out one. You've got to deal with one of the most difficult cost pressures, and that's security. And that's where we could get some, you know, help, but there's no response to that. Now, all of a sudden, we've got this, you know, ad hoc thing. Oh, we're going to get the Danforth. Great. Yeah, it's great it's coming back, but you got to do something in a systematic way and deal with the incredible cost of security that all these locally run BIA festivals incur.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question. And, you know, there are community events that are not like these festivals that also have security costs. And they are also quite crippling, John. So there's no question that that's a big issue. But one of the things that I kept hearing about the Taste of the Danforth was, gee, the vendors do huge business, make a lot of money, but they aren't contributing enough to the costs. Is that a valid criticism?
Well, I don't know that it is, because there is quite a heavy levy assessed to the vendors. I believe the last time they had it, the overall budget was about $1.7 million, and they had about $250,000 deficit in the vendors. So the vendors do pay quite a bit towards that. And, you know, all the festivals are different. Like Caravana and Gay Pride, they actually do get money from the city. So major festivals seem to get better support, and the federal government has committed a certain amount for security and mitigation, as has the city. I think Mayor Chow in 2025, so last year, she committed about 200 2.5 million in a pool for I think 64 different festivals. So the question—I
haven't done the math, but it doesn't come to a lot. Because...
It doesn't come to a lot, and that's the problem. And but you know, like the Taste of the Danforth is particularly expensive. I think it was Councillor Holliday that mentioned, or maybe it was Councillor Cole about the whole vehicle issue. And whereas out in Etobicoke in Centennial Park, they don't have that same problem. There are a couple main areas. It's in a park, right? So the costs are quite a bit different depending where you are. Caravana and Gay Pride going down, you know, Gay Pride going down Yonge Street, those costs are quite expensive because you need police officers pretty much at every side street. So it's never going to be enough, but this is one of those iconic ones. I'd say right up there with Caravana and Gay Pride, and I think all levels should support it.
Do any of you know where Taste of the Danforth ranks among the festivals in terms of popularity or attendance? Anybody know off the top of their head? Don't
well,
know.
It's one of the longest, as Mike Cole, it's one of the more established ones, and it's been one of the top 10. But that's changed now. You know, we've got the most amazing new festival now that's just exploding, our Salsa on St. Clair. And then there's the Ozfest down in Ossington. Those are exploding in terms of participation. And that's the only information I have about what's popular and what isn't. But there are changing trends.
Yes, Salsa on St. Clair is right up the street from where I live, and it does seem to be getting more popular and crowded every year. It's interesting. There are a lot of things, events that were iconic for years, and sometimes their time passes. And I keep wondering, is that the case for some of these street fairs? I know they are a lot about food. I hate to be a naysayer, but I find that the food at these things is not necessarily that good. And you see a lot of the same vendors, even if they're not in tune with the actual theme. Am I being a Grinch here, John?
Well, if I can jump in, Libby, you have to look at the street. Did it change? So, of course, Taste of the Danforth was all about Greektown. And I'm not saying Greektown is gone, but it's not the same Greektown that I remember from 20 years ago. There just seems to be less restaurants. It's reshaped a little bit. There's bike lanes there now. You know, it's certainly a different look and feel. And is our city changing, and have people found new places and new spots that they can still celebrate at? And are there emerging communities where there's different interest? And, you know, have those old businesses that are there, that have been there forever, that were the stanchions or the support of the festivals, have they moved on because we've moved on as a city? And, you know, maybe that's part of the thing that makes Toronto so exciting, is that it's dynamic and there are new things. But I would definitely say, back to your original question, Taste of Danforth is got to be one of the largest street-type festivals. And I'm keen on your observation about whether or not streets are the thing anymore, and if they haven't moved to different parts of the city that are different features.
You know, you bring up a very interesting point about the changing of our streetscapes. And I have to say, I used to live off the Danforth, and this was quite a while ago. It was 30 years ago, I guess. And even at that point, the Danforth had changed. There were still a lot of Greek businesses, but the actual Greek people, well, most of them had moved to the suburbs, and that changed the complexion. So I'd say even if neighborhoods are changing now, it has ever been thus, John.
Yeah, exactly. But back to the Taste of the Danforth, I think what they, and all these other festivals that are on streets, we need to come up with a policy that recognizes the cost of security vis-a-vis vehicle mitigation, and have some sort of formula, and then have markers where they have to hit it in terms of number of people attending and those sorts of things. And if they hit it, then they get funding the next year. The problem right now is everything is so ad hoc. It's who makes the loudest noise, who knows, you know, which politician. And I think that's one of the issues, is that we just don't have a template that we can assess what the need is and make sure that need is you know, being met in terms of people coming out and supporting as well.
Mike, would that be a good thing?
Yeah, no, I think I agree with John. I mean, the number one cost pressure is security. Now, the other thing is we got to remember is the silver lining in all this is that tourism in Toronto has increased. One of the reasons why a lot of people come to Toronto during the summer is for these local festivals on streets all over Toronto, and they're free of charge. Okay, you can, and then I know the food is your thing, Libby, but and my thing, but and the food is actually there's too many of these hot dog trucks, you know. What we need is more local food, and then to make sure that we also encourage the music. There's incredible groups that are coming in. I know we had 100,000 people at in Eglinton there for the Fairbank Village Festival to see Trooper. So music is also a big driver and a big attraction.
Let me give the numbers out again. People, send us a text or give us a call, 866-744-740. That is either a text or a call, or phone us at 416-360-0740. Do you have memories of attending these festivals? Did you go to the Taste of the Danforth? Would you go again? And if not, what are some other festivals that you might like to participate in? Let us know. I think that for a lot of people, these things are full of memories, hopefully very good ones. Before we move along to another topic, Mike, what would you say the biggest festival in your ward is?
Well, right now, it's actually the Eglinton Way Festival is probably the biggest. And that's the biggest because they have an antique car show that's included. They bring in incredible vehicles from across Ontario, and they basically are on Eglinton Avenue from Avenue Road to Spadina. And so it is really well attended, and the local merchants love it, and we have, you know, people that come in. They do a great job with the Eglinton Way Festival every year.
So again, people, give us a shout. Let us know what your favorite festivals are, what your memories are. However, moving right along. So the latest floor crossing announced yesterday was in Ottawa. It was a federal thing. Matt Genereux, Conservative MP, who said, oh, I'm not crossing. I'm just going to not run for re-election. I want to spend more time with my family. Yeah, right. That is, I think, just about the most tired excuse. And suddenly, well, he says, I changed my mind. You know, Mark Carney's speech was so good that I just happened to get in touch the week after another Liberal seat, well, one Liberal seat was nullified, was annulled by the courts. So my thinking, which, you know, in terms of how it's relevant to you, I mean, I'm thinking, this just makes people more cynical about politics, John.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that's the case. It may well be, certainly in that riding. But look, at the end of the day, Edmonton is one of those cities in Alberta that every so often they do elect Liberals. So he's got that in his favor. The question I have is what has been offered to him. I think that's where the cynicism will come in. If he all of a sudden takes a position, gets some sort of cabinet post or junior cabinet post, whatever the term they use, then I think the cynicism kicks in. But, you know, quite frankly, a lot of what Carney's been doing is a conservative agenda. So I think that that's in line. And I will say, if I were a member of the Conservative Party, I think they're, whatever it was, 87% support of Poilievre was really, they had the blinders on. And if I were a member of the Conservatives, I would think this party has no future under Pierre Poilievre. And, you know, politicians, they like to be with winners.
Okay. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think it's much ado about nothing. I mean, big deal. He crossed the floor. You know, and I think we've got bigger fish to fry and bigger challenges than worrying about some guy in Edmonton crossing over, and everybody's wringing their hands and crying foul. And, you know, let's get on with the incredible challenges we have in this country. We've got a huge threat from the economic threat, plus what's happening in the States. And we've got an economy that needs so much help, and the tariffs and public security issues. So, I mean, let's get on with the floor-crossing frenzy here.
Okay. Stephen, what do you think?
Oh, I've got a different position. There's an old saying that leopards rarely change their spots. And so people get a little... No, but, you know, people are people. You've got three politicians on this call, and we're all individuals. And we have our own individual beliefs, our approaches to things, what's important to us. And I would like to think that we're elected because of that, because people understand us and maybe see a little bit of themselves in us. Whether or not they agree on every topic, that's not going to happen. That's the nature of politics. But we are put in office based on trust. And this is a scenario where you've got a party system overlay. So the candidate is presented in the context of the party's platform, and they're put in. And, you know, I would even call Etobicoke Center one of those wards that tends to, or one of those areas of the country that tends to flip between conservatives and liberals. And that's because people are looking at the platforms. They know the people that are involved, and there's probably not a lot of differences in individuals. So I think you do create cynicism when this happens. I think it's a big deal, but it's a big deal locally. The problem is, if enough of this happens all over the place, that just builds further and further and further. And I think ultimately it makes our jobs harder as politicians. I have, you know, nothing to do with an elected member, as Councillor Cole said, over in Alberta. But, you know, people feel that. And maybe next time they talk to me, they just have that little bit more pent up amount of mistrust. And it's a shame, because I know all three of us on this call work really hard to earn people's trust and, you know, to serve our constituents. And when that baggage comes in from elsewhere, trying to solve an issue just becomes harder.
Okay, I've got a couple of texts and calls on this. So Steve in Brampton says, in business, we say if you want to get something done, you go to STPs, the same 10 people. I follow politics. I look at the leadership, the front bench, quality and policy. Then I vote the party of my choice, often knowing little or nothing about the local candidate. I suspect I'm not alone. In fact, I think we would be just as well served with fewer MPs. I feel betrayed by floor crossers, but it is part of our system. I would not vote for a floor crosser. Interesting comment. Let's hear from Daryl in Toronto. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, how you doing there? Anyway, so everyone's screaming disloyalty about this with the premise that someone gets into office by riding the coattails of the leader of the party. And is this not the same Conservative Party that for the last leader, who was it, Scheer? I can't even remember. But after losing an election, after about firstly, to elect them, they sold memberships. I think it was for $10 a piece so that people could vote for the leader. And then after the election, those members who had gotten elected again by riding the coattails of the leader turned around about 3 weeks later and overnight dumped them.
Yep.
So it seems kind of crazy to be screaming about this. You know, obviously this guy, I think he was waiting for the leadership review with Poilievre, and he decided that he'd rather, you know, be, if he could look at it as he wants to do something for his constituency or his riding, and he's not going to be able to do that under Poilievre.
Okay. We have time for one more sort of quick. Pat in Toronto. Hi, Pat.
Libby, one of the issues is that at both federal and provincial politics, you have to fall in line behind the leader. Otherwise, you're going to be out in the hallway. This is not the case at municipal politics, or is not supposed to be. And so I agree with the guy. I mean, I used to be a conservative, but I couldn't vote for Mr. Poilievre. And Mr. Carney has so much experience, you can't put a price on it. And as you know, many people like you and others don't want to run in politics. So we should, and I understand, but we should be so thankful that we get a man of his quality. It's just that simple.
I think, I've said this before, and a lot of people, I think, ascribe a lot of things to Carney that maybe he doesn't quite live up to. John, we're running out of time, but go ahead.
I'll be very quick. So I did look up the election results, and the Conservative, Matt, I believe he had 50%, and the Liberal had 45%. So this was not some blowout like in Alberta where it's 70-30 and you're really betraying a large number of people. The Liberal and the NDP, when you add them up, was basically 50%. So even without the NDP, he won by 5%. I don't know that you're really betraying, you know, maybe you're betraying the 50%, but the other 45 are pretty happy. That's a pretty close call.
Okay. On that note, we are going to wrap things up, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to say about this, and I'm going to be talking about it a little later in the show. People really don't like it, and I'm wondering, do we need a rule change about this? But in the meantime, let's get ready for those summertime festivals. Thank you so much, John Burnside, Stephen Holliday, and Mike Cole, and we will talk again soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Libby.
Thanks.
Take care, Steve. John.
Okay. We're taking a break, and when we come back, a fairly alarming new study on the ramifications of the shortage of primary care, of family doctors. It increases the risk of death if you've lost your doctor to retirement or a move or whatever. We'll talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. It is another sign of the dangers of our shortage of family doctors. A new study published in the journal Health Affairs Scholar found a higher risk of death in the first 5 years after individuals lose their primary physician. Now, researchers found a 12 times difference in the mortality rate when this was compared with healthy individuals who had family doctors, and patients who had multiple chronic conditions cost the health system up to $8,000 a year while they are waiting for a permanent family doctor. So those are pretty alarming numbers. And let us go to Dr. Nadia Alam, who is a family doctor and anesthetist in Georgetown, Ohio. Hi.
Ontario. Hi, Libby. How are you?
Oh, did I say Ohio? Okay, I'm sorry. It's one of those days.
I hear you. I had a start like that today, too.
So what do you make of this study?
It confirms a lot of what family doctors such as I, who are involved with health policy, have seen. It bears out a lot of what's been said before in the research. It also, I think what it adds, though, is this stark contrast, this drop in a patient's health status and an increase in their risk of getting sicker, of passing away over the 5 years after losing a family doctor. So it's not just that it highlights stuff that we've all known, right? We know that family doctors matter. We know that having one family doctor for each patient matters. We know that relationship built over years, trust built over years, managing a patient built over years matters. What we didn't realize was when that relationship ends, the consequences are much more severe.
One of the things I was wondering about, so a lot of people lose family doctors to retirement, but presumably the patients of those doctors are probably older than the general population of patients. So does that play into this?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. There are, what we've seen in terms of trends is a lot of things have been changing, Libby. The primary care community and the healthcare community by and large has become pretty volatile, right? Pretty uncertain in terms of funding, structure, resources, and burnout. So there are family doctors who are retiring younger. There are family doctors who are changing scope of practice. So they're moving from comprehensive care in an office, much like this, where I am today, to working just in hospitals or working just for a very focused practice like sports medicine or care of the elderly or dermatology, all of which are needed, but are happening because of the loss of that family doctor. So I think what the study highlights is that complex patients who lose their family doctors suffer significant consequences, but certainly young patients can. I can give you an example. During COVID, I came in contact with a patient who had been in his late 40s when his family physician retired. And he had been looking on and off for another family doctor, but he was generally healthy, so he didn't feel that pressure. Now, age 50 is when we start doing a lot of screening tests for regular risk patients, your average run-of-the-mill patient. So he didn't get to do his screening test because he wasn't able to find a family doctor. I came across him because I do palliative care in the community. I do anesthesia. That day, I was providing sedation for colonoscopies. He had come in because of rectal bleeding. He did not have his colon cancer screening, and lo and behold, he had colon cancer. And in fact, he passed away within a year of diagnosis. That's how far it had progressed. Now, if he had been screened, and this was at the age of early 50, so if he had been screened at age 50, we could have found it earlier. We could have done something more about it. Instead, he became my palliative patient, which is devastating.
It is absolutely devastating. You know, when I saw this study and they said patients with complex conditions would cost an extra $8,000 a year, I actually, Nadja, thought that was low.
As far as healthcare costs go, that's pretty significant. That's pretty significant. But it tells you how we're used to hearing about how much Canada spends on healthcare and what the perception is among people on how Ontario spends on healthcare. But interestingly, I mean, the Toronto Star article that talked about this study and even in the study itself, they compared it to Norway. And interestingly, Norway spends more on primary care. So it doesn't just matter that we're how much money we're spending. It also matters where we spend that money. And that's where outcomes do make a big difference. Now, I see Dr. Jonathan Fitzsimmons, who's one of the authors of the study, is on. So I'm going to be quiet and let him talk.
Okay. Yes. Let's bring in Dr. Jonathan Fitzsimmons, who is a family physician and one of the authors of the study. And what made you decide to take a look at this factor?
Hi, thanks for hosting me. I'm really really pleased to be with you today. I think what drove this research was just look, we it's become so front and center across Ontario and across Canada, the crisis in primary care, just how many people don't have access to a family doctor or a primary care home. And what we wanted to show was just the significance on different groups of people. So it's become clear to me, as you know, I'm a family doctor as well as a researcher, that you can't treat everybody equally. Like, the impact is not the same on everyone. If you're a relatively healthy person, you don't have any chronic conditions, absolutely you should have a family doctor. Absolutely you should have primary care, preventative care, having a touch point, having someone that knows you and gets to know your health and your needs is really, really important for your long-term outcomes. But in the immediate sort of near future, perhaps if you don't have a doctor now and you get attached in a year or two or 3 years, it will be fine. But there is this group of people who have such high needs now. It's really impacting them. I see it in my clinical practice, and I really wanted us to delve into the numbers and have some hard evidence, some robust peer-reviewed evidence that sort of backs up this claim that chronic conditions make a huge impact on people and on the system.
Well, obviously, and we have an aging population, which means a lot of people with chronic conditions. And as we've gone along here, we've updated the province's efforts to connect people. That's under the leadership of Dr. Jane Philpott. There's a primary care action plan. And Dr. Fitzsimmons, is there any kind of differentiation within that? You know, she talks about using postal codes, but to try to give priority to people who do have complex conditions, or is that kind of too hard to drill down on?
I think the initial approach has been to recognize that the number is huge, and we need to do something about it, and we need to do something about it quickly. And, you know, hats off to Dr. Philpott and her team, and credit where it's due for, you know, for the Ontario government for actually sort of, you know, putting money up and putting legislation forward so that it is now, you know, in Ontario's legislation that all Ontarians will have access to a family doctor or primary care provider by 2029. And I think they made that sort of decision that we need to make a difference quickly. We need to start seeing results. And so those first efforts were based on communities that had the highest numbers of people, the highest total numbers of people who didn't have access to a doctor. And I think, you know, in the next waves of the impacts and the funding from Dr. Philpott's team are starting to look at some of the more subtle differences between where we can have the best impact, the highest impact. And I do hope that this research can help guide that as well, that this population is at highest risk and also can have the highest impact.
Nadja, do you think there's anything in the way this is rolling out to allow for that, number one? And frankly, I've heard stories. I mean, you know, it's frankly scary when you hear about the numbers of patients that a family doctor has. It's in the hundreds. It's sometimes close to 1,000. And I've heard stories about doctors who they'll take maybe a young and healthy person, but they don't necessarily want another person who's going to take up a lot of their time and energy.
It's a really complicated scenario. So one, just to be clear, the work that Dr. Philpott and her team are doing that's supported by the government is to provide funding for interprofessional teams. So not necessarily family doctors,
yeah.
Teams of nurses, nurse practitioners, social workers, pharmacists, et cetera, who are key people within a team. I do agree with Dr. Fitzsimmons that it would be nice to know, given the scarcity of resources and funding that we're facing, that is our reality, where do we get the best bang for our buck? Where should we be putting the money as much as possible? Funding for family physicians recently changed, right? It's evolved a bit further. And it's evolved because the government has negotiated a new funding arrangement with the Ontario Medical Association to support family medicine. And so hopefully that will encourage physicians to be able to do proper care of these complex patients, because complex patients are really hard to take care of. They're fun. I really enjoy it. A lot of my practice tends to be more complex, leans towards the more complex patients, but I can understand why there are physicians who'll say, I'm maxed out in terms of being able to manage complexity. I need some simple patients to just help balance things out. Family doctors love variety. And so those who are in comprehensive care, you want some who are not just young and healthy, you want some who are young women of childbearing age, you want kids in your practice, you want elderly people in your practice, you want that full spectrum, that richness of variety in your practice. And then there are family doctors like me who tend to lean towards a particular kind of patient. But what that means for a patient who's coming in, they don't really know. And so They just want a family doctor to take care of them. There are efforts underway between different OHT, so Ontario Health Teams, which are the mini healthcare systems scattered around Ontario, to try and match patients with family doctors. But I do agree with Dr. Fitzsimon. We need to make that a bit more nuanced. It's not just about headcounts. We also need to take into account complexity.
Okay, Dr. Fitzsimon, I'm going to give you the last word, but we're out of time, so no more than 30 seconds, please.
Yeah, I think that point is super important. We have to be able to support family doctors to support the most complex patients. And if that means being creative in compensation mechanisms, in work practices, those doctors that want to care for more complex patients, it has to be viable for them to do that. And I would finish off by saying I totally agree. It's incredibly professionally rewarding to help people with complex needs and see the difference you can make in their lives.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Dr. Nadia Alam and Dr. Jonathan Fitzsimon. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Libby, I hope you have a great day.
You too. All righty. So we are taking another break. When we come back, we're going to talk a bit more about that floor crossing. We have some more texts to get to, too. It's a subject definitely our audience wants to weigh in. And also, I hope we'll have time to get to the arrest of the former Prince Andrew. And I'm wondering if this marks a whole new kind of a turn in that whole saga when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the latest conservative defection to the Liberals puts the Carney government closer to a majority and gets rid of the need for a by-election in that riding. And it is a staunchly conservative riding, both federally and provincially. So there's no question that many voters feel betrayed. Now, polls show that most voters hate floor crossing, even though it is perfectly legal in our system. And they certainly at least hate it when it comes without an immediate resignation and election call. So one question I have is, do we need a rule change on this matter? And is that something that's even possible? The texts and long distance phone line, 866-744-740. The local phone line, 416-360-0740. So let us go to Lisa Raitt, former deputy leader of the Conservative Party of Canada and Will Stewart, a conservative strategist and senior VP with Enterprise Canada. Hello, and thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, Libby. Hi, Will.
Hey, Libby. Hi. Good to see you. Good to see you, Lisa. Best MP I ever had, Lisa Raitt, right there.
Okay, there we go. So let's start with Lisa. One of the things I'm hearing a lot, oh, this is dire for the Conservatives, big leadership problem, even though there was just a leadership review. What's your view of that?
I'm going to say it's not a big problem, but it is an indicator that there's work to be done within the caucus. And that includes what's happening in Ottawa. I would say that if I was a sitting MP right now, I would be looking around the room when I'm in the caucus room and saying, am I doing everything I can to reach out to my colleagues to make sure that they have a connection with me so that if they're thinking about moving to another party, at least they give me a call and I get a chance to talk them out of it and tell them that they're part of the family. By the way, Libby, genius that you have Will and I together on this one, because if it wasn't for Garth Turner crossing the floor and Will Stewart actually asking me to run in the riding, we would not be here today. So proof point on how I don't mind floor crossers.
Oh, well, I have to say, I'm trying to remember the year because I was still, was I still in Ottawa then? What year was that?
Oh, wait. It was 08. Oh. 08. So Garth crossed the floor in 07, I think, Will. And then the election came in 08 and Will came to my door and said, hey, would you like to run?
That strategic genius Garth Turner crossed the floor from the Stephen Harper Conservatives to the Stephan Dionne Liberals. Oh. What a brilliant move, Mr. Turner. And I know you still listen because you write cookbooks on how to cook squirrels when capitalism collapses. And I'm not making this up. He does. He's in London and he's a financial advisor and a squirrel
cuisine advisor,
I guess.
You know, sometimes I think, thank goodness I don't remember this stuff. It was all too weird. I remember something about him as a financial advisor. People, maybe try somebody else. But what are the, I mean, you know, and Lisa, as somebody who is and has been a caregiver, you know, that this really shop-worn, I'm doing it to spend more time with my family. Actually, you know, when I think about it, it's only generally women who actually mean that when they take time off politics. And this is, you know, when some of these guys say it, it's an eye roll.
I just eye rolled when you said that. So you're right. And it is a trope. They should stop using it. I truly believe that in some cases, people want to reconnect with their family. I get it. But that's just an addition. You're not leaving because you want to be with your family. You're leaving for a whole bunch of other reasons. Right, Will?
We're not leaving. Yep.
Or not leaving. What are the ramifications of this in your view, Will?
Look, I think, you know, this is a very cynical move by Matt Genereau, right? He said he wanted to spend time with his family. Turns out the families of Liberal MPs don't want to spend time with them. And we have to entertain them back in the House of Commons like other cabinet ministers in the Trudeau world, like Anita Anand, who I quite like, but did the same thing. Mark Miller did the same thing. So it's a little bit. Yeah, it's a little bit threadbare at this point. But look, as you pointed out off the top, there's nothing illegal about it. But what this actually does is it reduces the citizen's view of politicians. This is an individual who said he wanted to spend time with his family, and now he's not. This is an individual who has run and won 6 times as a conservative. He's not all of a sudden a liberal. He's an opportunist. Let's call him what he is, right? He's run and won 6 times as a conservative. And let's not forget, his riding has never once in its history elected a liberal. So what this individual should do is he should actually resign and go to a by-election. And you ask the question off the top, should we have a rule change? I think we should. But, you know, we don't have that right now. You know, but these floor crossers don't work out well for Liberal governments. I mean, remember Belinda Stronach crossing to save Paul Martin, who then went down to defeat to the Conservatives in the very next election. I expect the same thing here. It's just a matter of time. We'll let the Liberals pop their champagne corks and do their tricks and attack people with maybe sort of questionable affiliations in Markham, that floor crosser there, as we've learned as of yesterday. But the fact of the matter is it doesn't turn out well for Liberals because citizens don't like this type of cynical partisan approach to politics. We're told that we're here for change. We're told that we have to be serious, and we're running around giving fake titles to floor crossers, which is exactly what Mr. Carney did yesterday. So I'm tired of it. I think Canadians are tired of it. Of course, I'm going to be bitter about it. I'm a conservative, but let's actually call it for what it is. Right?
Go Will.
And I mean, this thing he got didn't sound like very much, Lisa.
Oh, no, he's got a ticket to travel. Oh. Right. That's what he's been given. He's been given a ticket to pick a country that you want to go to do a trade negotiation or discussion with. And off you go. Indonesia, Japan, India, you pick it. We're going to take you along for the ride. And that's it. Which is even less time with his family, Will, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we'll be watching. Conservatives will be watching those expenses. You know, we know Mark Carney has spent over $700,000 on just catering on his flight. And I'm for the prime minister being out and about. I do believe he has to meet face-to-face with folks. But you know what? Maybe a can of pop and a granola bar would do better than a filet mignon, given the affordability crisis that we're facing in Canada right now.
Or maybe folks instead of the highfalutin world-class globetrotters that he favors, Lisa. That's interesting. And I was going to say, and we'll have to check to make sure he doesn't take any family members on those junkets, because that's where they can get tripped up as well. Let's read a couple of texts, and we have somebody who didn't leave their name. I believe that an MP knows where the leader is going. If they choose to change parties, if they are uncomfortable, they should change. Okay, that's one very tolerant leader. Let's go to Don in Hamilton. Isn't a more fundamental question Why are, oh, he's texting about something else, so never mind that. Floor crossing. One of my early mentors had a motto about politics and politicians, T-A-L, they all lie. This works for floor crossers. This is from Jerry. And I think that goes exactly to what you were saying, Will. I think that all this stuff, which to me is so tired, just hurts all politicians.
Yeah, and I think that's where it is. And people are exhausted by this. And look, I don't think all politicians are liars and frauds. And we're here with a politician, with Lisa Raitt, who I have a lot of time for. I've spent 25 years around politics in Canada, and I don't believe that people are liars and want to do ill. And that goes for all people in all parties. I do believe that. People join public life because they want to make a difference, for sure. We might agree or disagree with those differences. But to say a pox on all their houses, they're all liars, that's just simply not true. And we have to stand up and say things about that. But it does illustrate how tired people are of these type of backroom games. And, you know, Canadians did collectively what they couldn't do individually. They elected a minority government, a third minority government in a row for the Liberals. That's what Canadians decided. Now that's being changed by 300 odd MPs and the backroom advisors in Ottawa. Also, completely fair, completely above board. But you have to expect some cynicism from voters as a result of it. And that's what we're seeing.
And my frustration, Libby, to be honest, is all of the rumors about, oh, there's more to come. I would say to all those more to comes, get it over with. Like, I'm sick of hearing about the rumors. If you're going to go, just go. Like, put us all out of our misery. Just make the trip across the floor and be done with it. And like, so we can get on with our lives doing what we need to do in the Conservative Party instead of worrying about you guys.
That's a good thought to end things up on. And I have to say, I agree with Will. I don't think that politicians are liars. I don't think that they're in it for whatever the junket. I think most of them have good motives, but some of the things that are done, you know, make people cynical.
Yep.
For sure.
On that note, we wrap things up, and we'll see if there are more to come, to your point, Lisa. In the meantime, thanks so much to both Lisa Raitt and Will Stewart. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Talk to you later, Will.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. That's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. People, Free For All Friday is coming up tomorrow, and I could not get to all the texts and the phones. So please call back tomorrow for Free For All Friday, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.